Okay, welcome everyone. So let us start the Dhamma talk for tonight. And I was asked to talk a little bit about the things, the Easter terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka, and a little bit about how to view that from a Buddhist perspective, how to think about it, and how to deal with it. And I think that is a very useful thing to do. And it is very often when we kind of, when things, difficult things happen in life, and very often we become more open to the Dhamma and to seeing the world in a new way. So it often kind of supplies a useful perspective when you go through these difficult times. As was mentioned by Lehar just before the talk, my own father also passed away about 4 weeks ago now, just over 4 weeks ago. That's another one of those kind of big events in life, or can be, at least, depending on how you look at it. And that too kind of provides you with a perspective on life, and you think, look at life in a little bit different way when these things happen. And especially interesting when you are a Buddhist monk, because you think that you have reflected on these things, and you think, yeah, when it happens, it will be, you know, you can deal with it. And so it's always fascinating. Have I really dealt with it? Have I really thought about it properly? Will I be able to deal with it when it happens? So you never really know until it happens. But as it turned out, it wasn't such a big problem, to be honest. It sort of worked itself out very nicely, I thought. And I should perhaps say that I got so many beautiful messages, yeah, by email from around the world, from so many different places, so many people here at the Buddhist Society. And one of the great things about being a monk is that you are the beneficiary of so much kindness from everywhere around the world. Yeah, and that is enough reason, I say, to be a Buddhist monk already. Just because people are kind to you. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. Yeah. So thank you everyone. I didn't really reply to any of those emails because I thought it was just a little bit too much. But I certainly does not mean I don't appreciate it. It's very, very kind of you. But as I said, it's not when you've been a Buddhist monk for a long time, you're able to deal with these things in a fairly kind of good way. Doesn't lead to too much problems. One of the things maybe I should start with, so these are the two issues. You have the terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka, and then you have my own father passing away, and obviously there's a lot of connection between those two things. It's about kind of big things happening in our life and a kind of new perspective, and about life and death and these issues. So many things in common, but one thing that you might feel is different between these two things is that many people would look at these events quite differently. And the way that we normally look at someone dying because of old age or sickness or whatever, our reaction very often is one of sorrow and sadness when that happens. But you don't normally get angry when that happens. Yeah, you don't normally get angry if someone passes away. It's just part of nature. So you accept it in a certain way for what it is. But when something happens, like as in Sri Lanka, we tend to look at it in a different way, because we think of it not just as a natural phenomenon that happens in the world, but we feel that because it was deliberately done, it was someone behind it, there was kind of all this agency coming into it, very often, instead of just feeling sad about it, you also tend to get a bit upset perhaps, or angry about these things. So it looks like these things are slightly different. But what is interesting, and one of the reasons why I'd like to kind of look at them together, is that from a deeper perspective, actually, they are both just natural things happening, really, according to cause and conditions. So whether someone dies of natural causes, or you have a terrorist attack like this, actually, on a deeper level, it is still very similar in many ways. And this is a very important thing, because this leads us on to a more deeper understanding of the purpose of the spiritual path, how to look at life and how to understand life in a way that actually enhances your spiritual practice and also your meditation practice here. So before I go on to that, though, that equality between the two things and how to use that, I want to start out by talking a little bit about what happened in Sri Lanka specifically. And the reason for that is because with these attacks, It is quite natural that people often feel anger, they feel upset, they feel all of these negative emotions coming up. So even though in a deeper sense it may not be required, we need to kind of try to understand how to deal with these emotions. I think most people who are Buddhist or on a spiritual path realize that anger and upset is not going to solve any issues. So how can we deal with these things? How can we look at life in such a way as to reduce some of the problem in a case such as this? And often it can be very traumatic, yeah? It's like a whole nation is traumatized because there are so many people dying. I think the latest count, 260 people or something. So very large number, lots of people injured. So it can be very traumatizing. How do we deal with this? To deal with this, I always like to go back to the suttas of the Buddha, and this is a particular passage or a sutta, the discourse of the Buddha that is very well known, and many of you will have heard of this particular passage, and it's a very powerful passage because it is very demanding to really understand what the Buddha is talking about. And this is the Buddha's famous simile of the saw that many of you will know about. And this is really demanding. I remember when I first read the simile of the saw, I was kind of reading through it and I thought, whatever. I turned the page and carried on. It's just too much. Yeah, it's kind of, whoa, this is just, I can't really deal with this. Once you kind of look at it more deeply and you think about it for a while and you start to you get the idea that the Buddha does things because the integrity of his teaching is such that you've got to take these things seriously. You can start to look at it again and again and again. And after a while, it starts to come out what the message of the simile actually is. And the simile of the saw is as follows. It is when a person gets kind of pinned down on the ground, and two strong people come out with a long saw, a really long saw, kind of big teeth, and really kind of, and then they take the saw, and they start to saw you apart, limb by limb, one limb after the first your legs, then your arms, and then who knows what next, if there's anything more to be done after that, probably not, probably too late already. But anyway, so someone pins you down, saws you apart, limb from limb, yeah? So you are sitting here, you're lying on the ground here, we get some volunteers to saw you apart, and then we'll see what happens. This is the Buddha's test, yeah, to see how, if you're a good Buddhist or not. So what does the Buddha say here? Yeah, how are you a good Buddhist? Well, the Buddha says that if you give rise to one angry thought while these people are sawing you apart limb by limb, if you curse them or you get angry in the slightest way, then the Buddha says, you're not following my teaching here. What you should do when people saw you apart limb by limb, you should have a mind of loving kindness. And starting with them, you should have loving kindness for the entire world. You should have loving kindness, compassion for these people. That is what the Buddha says we should be doing here. And this is what I'm saying. Yeah, first time I read this, I thought, whatever. I carried on because I couldn't kind of compute. Yeah, this was just too much. What is the Buddha talking about? Maybe I found the wrong religion or something. Maybe this is just, what is he? He's asking too much. But that is kind of what makes the Buddhist teaching interesting, is that sometimes you come across teachings like that that seem to be way beyond what you normally are able to deal with. So how do we look at a teaching like this in a way that actually we can make sense of it? And then, of course, once you can accept that kind of teaching, then perhaps you can also be able to deal with the things that happen in Sri Lanka or other terrorist attacks or whatever it is, because these are similar kind of problematic things to deal with. And the answer is that if you are pinned down to the ground and someone is sawing you apart limb by limb, sure, it is painful, it is unpleasant, it is very difficult. But within a few minutes, you're going to be bleeding so profusely if your legs are cut off and your arms are cut off. Within a minute or two, you're going to be dead. Yeah, you're dead, no big deal, you're dead. And then if you imagine, if you're lying there and you have a mind of loving kindness towards these people at the same time, if you die with a mind of loving kindness to people who are so cruel, imagine where you get reborn as a consequence of that. You go straight up, bang, straight into a heavenly realm. And when you go to the straight heavenly realm, you're so happy up there, you're going to thank those people with a sword on the bottom. Thank you for sending me up to this beautiful heavenly realm. Isn't that great? Isn't that kind of turning things really upside down? But imagine the problem for those people who actually do the sawing. here you have this very pure person who's sending out loving kindness to you, even when you torture them in the worst possible way, yeah, in a very terrible way, and then they still do this, they saw your part, and then you die as a consequence. Imagine how they feel about themselves afterwards. Yeah, right there, if you do that to someone who is so virtuous, you're going to feel terrible about yourself. And of course, the consequences in the long run of doing very terrible things is that you drag yourself down. Your entire consciousness gets dragged down to a darker state. And that darker state you're in is then going to affect the way you get reborn afterwards in a very, very bad way. The person, the people who are really suffering in the simile of the soul is not so much the person who is dying, who's been sawn apart. The persons who are really creating a problem for themselves are the ones who are doing the sawing. They are the ones who really are in trouble. They are the ones who have no clue as to what they're doing. What is so interesting about people and humanity in general is that we always think that what we do is right. Yeah, guarantee that this terrorists in Sri Lanka, they thought they were doing something good, otherwise they wouldn't do it. We always think that what we're doing is right. In the same way, these people who saw someone apart, limb by limb, they think in one way or another that they're actually doing something right in this world. In other words, they are deluded. They think that they're creating happiness, when what they actually are creating for themselves and others is just suffering and nothing else. They are blind. Yeah, they have no idea what they're doing. This is the problem. And if you are blind and it is dark because you're blind and you walk around, you can't see what is going on. You hit your head here and there. And of course, the suffering is enormous because of that. So these people are blind to what they're doing. They have no idea what is going on. Yeah, they're creating more suffering for themselves than for anyone else. So what is your attitude going to be to these people? You're going to have, if you are smart about it, you're going to have some degree of compassion, because they are just terribly misguided as to what is going on. And this is really the idea here. When you do this, something wonderful and marvelous happens. When we tend to focus too much on ourselves, when we focus on how we suffer because of the way the world outside impacts us, and very often it feels like the world outside impacts us in a very bad way, and we suffer as a consequence, and then you kind of become scared of the world outside, you blame the world outside, and what happens is that you go inside of yourself, and you feel this sense of me against the world, or the world against me. Yeah, this is what you do when we focus too narrowly on ourselves. But if you're able to understand that actually the world is just the world, the world does its own things, and then you have compassion, not only for the victims of terrible crimes, but also for the perpetrators. What happens then, instead of focusing on yourself very narrowly, you expand out the focus, and you start to understand, you start to have compassion for the world at large, for all of these things out there, perpetrators, victims alike, and everyone. And instead of having this narrow little me against the world, you expand your mind out, and the whole world is included within that mind. And what a beautiful thing that is. And all you really have to do is this tiny little trick of perception. Instead of focusing on your pain, you understand the broader pain that is around all of us, including the people who actually are the terrorists. So in this way, we can expand out. Of course, you have compassion for the victims. It's terrible to have so many victims. It's terrible that so many families will have to suffer as a consequence. So of course, we have compassion for the victims. We do our best to help them out. We give them some shelter. We do what we can to ensure that they also get through this in a good way. Give them some psychological means to deal with the problem. But the right way is not to have a sense of anger toward the perpetrators, but also try to bring them in as well into our compassion. And when we do that, we start to be able to deal with these problems in a far, far clearer way. And this is one of the big advantages of this. Because once you are angry, once you are upset about things, it's almost impossible to deal with these things in a rational way, because you are already deluded, you have a vested interest in what you want to do, in the object, in the anger, whatever it is. It's very difficult for you to actually be able to deal with the problem in a rational way. But if you say, stop, let me look at this in a different way, then you can see things more clearly, and then you can often deal with the causes of the problem in a positive way, and then hopefully get out of that situation. There's too much revenge in this world. Too much kind of anger that carries on from generation to generation. And this is what we're doing if we just seek revenge and we are angry and we are upset about what is happening here. I recall there was I'm not sure when this was. This was in Afghanistan at some stage. Whether it was when the Americans invaded Afghanistan or when the British invaded Afghanistan. The British invaded Afghanistan back in the 19th century, I think. When they invaded, they were really angry with the British, or was it with the Americans? I'm not sure now which one it was. And they were really angry. One of the reasons they were angry here, because they were still upset about Alexander the Great invading Afghanistan 2,200 years ago. Yeah? 2,200 years ago, Alexander the Great came from Greece, invaded Afghanistan, and they were still angry about that. So when the British came, they were going to put up a real strong resistance against the British. This is kind of the way to carry a grudge for a long time. 2,200 years, I don't know, it probably isn't the record, but it's pretty good, pretty amazing that you can carry it for so long here. So I thought about that. I thought this is very fascinating here, yeah, how we carry these things on here. Probably the grudge is passed on from father to son, generation after generation. Don't forget, son, Alexander the Great was here 1,500 years ago. Next generation, 1,800 years ago. Yeah, don't forget to carry this grudge. So next time around, we have a chance to kind of make up. Yeah, we're going to get those people. Yeah, they're still there in Greece. Next time we have an opportunity, we're going to take revenge on these things. And I thought it was astonishing. How can you remember something for 2,200 years in that particular culture? But this is a bit like the idea of revenge. It never comes to an end. It just carries on and on like that. Yeah, down the, and then one person takes revenge, and then the other person wants to have revenge again. And there's this endless cycle going back and forth. And the only way to break that cycle is to have a different attitude and allow it, to let it go and to let it be. Like that beautiful verse in the Dhammapada, which says that hatred never ceases through hatred in this world. Hatred only ceases through love. This is an eternal law. It's beautiful. And when you, I would recommend you, if you have the chance, if you, you know, every time you go to bed at night, have the Dhammapada on your bedside, read a couple of beautiful verses to inspire you, and you fall asleep. Oh, and you sleep so well afterwards. You wake up in the morning energized and happy because of that. So this is, to me, the right attitude. The Buddha says very beautifully, this is in a sutta in the connected discourses of the Buddha, he says that when there is suffering, people tend to react in one of two ways. One way is that you get deluded. Yeah, and you get deluded because when you suffer, you get angry with the perpetrators of the crime, or you get upset about what is going on, or because you can't really deal with the pain, you allow yourself to go into tiredness and dullness of the mind, you just become confused because you don't know, oh, the world, what is happening with the world? Everything is going the wrong way. You get confused about things. So one response to dukkha, to suffering, is often a sense of delusion, not knowing what is going on. But the Buddha says there's another response, and that is the response called confidence or faith. Faith that there is something else in the world, something more worthwhile. And that faith becomes very beautiful and very powerful in a situation such as Sri Lanka, where so many people die, and you kind of feel the world is just out of control. Yeah, what a wonderful thing it is that I have the Dhamma, that I have something more profound, where I can find some kind of refuge away from that, where I can actually develop other qualities that actually really matter. And of course, the second point is that it gives direct faith in the Buddha's teachings, because the Buddha says that there is suffering. First noble truth, yeah? Suffering is a problem. And you realize, actually, this is what he's talking about. Our first reaction is very often, there shouldn't be terrorism in the world. There shouldn't be problems in the world. Our security forces should be better at finding out the problems so we can avoid them in the future. That tends to be very often the first reaction. How can we resolve this? But of course, the point is, there is suffering in this world. You cannot really avoid it. And this is kind of often what becomes clear when you see this big problems arising. Now it's terrorist attacks. In the past it was maybe wars or whatever. But the idea, the problems are exactly the same. And again, it gives you confidence in these teachings. And it gives you confidence that there is also a way out. So this is really the first thing. Remember the simile of the soul. And if you can remember the simile of the soul and you can live according to that, can you? Is anyone here who can live according to the symbol of the sword? You cannot? Okay. That's very honest, isn't it? Not yet, anyway. It's always not yet, yeah? It's just the beginning here. So now you kind of have the kind of spirit to kind of get there. So not yet is always the right answer. Anyone else who can live according to the symbol of the sword? Maybe. Maybe not. Okay. It's hard, isn't it? But it's actually very beautiful because it shows you the potential for the development of the human mind. The potential is so great. Don't feel that it is the Buddha is asking too much. Instead of thinking the Buddha is asking too much, instead think, here is the potential. Wow, isn't that wonderful? Let me be inspired by the simile and maybe I can kind of do something. Maybe not all the way, but I can go some of that way in the future. And I always like to say to people that, well, if next time around, maybe in a year's time, we have practiced really well, we will test you, yeah? Put you down in front here, and we'll get the vice president of the Buddhist advocate out of Big Saw, and then we'll see what happens. Or maybe I should be the one who's tested, yeah? Maybe that's more fair, I don't know. Anyway, one of these days, yeah? One of these days, we kind of have some kind of really, maybe get one of these magicians or something to do it for us. Yeah? Anyway, so that is the how to deal with the anger or the upset, yeah? Or the ideal way of dealing with that, understanding the larger picture of things, and then you can actually change your attitude to these things. It's a big demand, but it can be done, at least to some extent. Yeah. But I want to come back now to my own father's passing away, which was, as I said, a very interesting experience in many ways for me. And I went back to Norway straight away to kind of visit my family and my mother in particular. It's very difficult, especially when you have lived for someone for 60 years. Yeah, over 60 years. It is very hard to take anyone's death because it leaves a big gaping hole in your life. And suddenly it's very hard to fill that hole again afterwards. So I went back, and one of the things that I always see when I see people passing away, and also when my father passed away, is people saying, oh, it happened so fast. Yeah, suddenly it came out of the blue and it happened. I didn't really have time to say all the things I wanted to say, you know, to whoever it is that is dying. I wanted to say this, I wanted to say goodbye properly. Didn't have time for that. And sometimes you hear, you know, people are in hospital with cancer, very seriously ill, they're lying in their bed and everyone knows they're dying. And still they say, oh, it happened so fast. What do you mean it happened so fast? I've been lying in this bed for 3 weeks, you know, going downhill. But still, we think it's going to be tomorrow, or it's going to be the day after. It's never going to happen now. It happens suddenly. And this is kind of the point of death. It always happens when you don't expect it. Yeah, it is always going to be one more day. You'd never really expect it. But remember, death doesn't work like that. One day you are alive, next day you are dead. One day someone is alive, the next day they are dead. And having contemplated these Buddhist teachings for a long time, I took that on board and I tried my very best over a long period of time, actually many, many years now, to make sure that I try, not just with my family, with my father, but also with other people, try to say the right thing at all times, because I know tomorrow I may not see you again. And the same thing with my father. So I realized, I was youthful and kind of crazy and a teenager once myself and did many, many stupid things. I'm not going to talk about it here because it's too embarrassing. But did many bad things. Yeah, this is going to be in my biography after I'm dead. The biography is going to come out. They're going to talk about those bad things, not while I'm alive. So I realized there's a lot of things to be said. There are things to be asked forgiveness for, and there are things to be said which are kind of the positive side of life. Yeah, and my father was in many ways a very good man. So there's a lot of things to be grateful for. Yeah, he did a good job trying to bring us up. He allowed me to become a monk. Yeah, isn't that amazing? Most parents, yeah, if you say I want to be a monk, say absolutely no way. There's no way you're going to be a monk. Yeah. And it's very common, especially you travel around Asia, you meet many different Asian cultures. There are so many monks, but actually sometimes very hard for the child to become a monk because the parents hold them back. Okay, if the child is really kind of, if the child is very gifted, then absolutely no way they become a monk. But if they are a bit kind of on the dumb side, okay, maybe then you can become a monk. That's the way it usually works, yeah? Being a monk is kind of the bottom of the bottom if you are a monk. Yeah, it's really kind of the outcast of society here. Yeah. So, but my father allowed me to become monk. Yes, yeah? So I have a lot to be grateful for, at least after a bit of persuasion. He wasn't happy straight away, but a bit of persuasion said, okay, gritting his teeth, okay, you can become a monk. Yeah? This is how I ended up becoming a monk. So pretty kind of forward-looking father. And so many good qualities. And I, for that reason, it was easy to focus on that and to kind of have a very, very good relationship with him towards the end. And of course, what happens is that when your child becomes a monk, very often has very powerful consequences on you as a parent as well. And towards the end, my father was pretty much, he was almost a Buddhist, yeah, because he thought his teachings were very interesting. Yeah. That was very fascinating to see that change. And all of that was, this is one of the things that is very important to remember when people pass away. Remember, you may never see anyone again. We never have the opportunity, it is never the right time to do anything bad towards another person. Because next time you see them, you may not see them. They may not be there anymore. They may be gone. And this is the problem. So we don't have an opportunity really to do anything bad against anyone. Always we should do what is right. Because only then do we have the conscience is clear. And then we can kind of pass away, or they can pass away in a good way. So I felt very much at ease when my father eventually passed away. I went back to Norway and I was given the chance to do the funeral service for my father. It's kind of nice, isn't it? Have you ever thought of doing the funeral service for your parents when they pass away? It was very, very nice. There was a large gathering, maybe there were well over 200 people present. And none of them were Buddhist. I was the only one who was Buddhist in the entire congregation. Okay, my family is kind of semi-Buddhist, yeah? But everyone else, they were complete, I don't know what they were, materialists probably, yeah? Into BMWs and that sort of stuff. It's a wonderful thing to have this opportunity to say the final goodbye to your father, to thank him for the final time, and to send him onward in a good way, in this way. It was very, very powerful, actually. It was also quite difficult. One thing is to give a Dhamma talk to people who we don't know all that well. But when you have to stand in front of 200 people, and your families and all your friends and everyone, and talk in a language you don't really know all that well anymore. Yeah, I'm supposed to be Norwegian, but actually I can talk Dhamma much better in English than I can in Norwegian. So you kind of always a bit shaky. But what is so beautiful about it, and what is so, one of the things I really loved about this, apart from the fact that I can send my father off in a good way, which is very powerful and very beautiful, but is the feedback you got afterwards. Because you realize that in a society that is mostly Christian or mostly atheist or whatever it is, it's not really Christian anymore, it's kind of just the Christian culture lingering on really. But in a society like that, people are used to sad funerals. Christianity very often has sad funerals, yeah? But then you give a different spin on things. I didn't really do a Buddhist funeral because I didn't do any Buddhist chanting and all that kind of thing. I didn't do anything very religious at the funeral service. But I used Buddhist ideas in the way I talked about my father's life. And nobody cried. My mother didn't even cry. Yeah, that's kind of my mother, you expect her to cry because she was kind of so close to my father, obviously. Even my mother didn't cry. And then I said, the music shall not be sad. The music shall be uplifting. So we had uplifting music. And the whole thing was a very beautiful experience. And people came afterwards and said, wow, that was so nice. I've never been to a funeral service that was so uplifting and so inspiring as this one. Usually I dread funeral services, but this one was a good one. Yeah, so next time we have a funeral service here as the BSW, please come around. And sometimes you feel uplifted when you see these things. And that was so powerful. It showed me that in a society, nobody there was Buddhist. How powerful these teachings can be to people who have no idea about Buddhism, who probably have very, very few spiritual values, and yet somehow this actually touched them in a very deep way. When someone passes away, it's often a very good time to talk about just common sense ideas. Yeah, these are Buddhist ideas, but they're also common sense, and it goes deep into people's hearts. And it reminds me of how accessible these teachings are if they are presented in the right way at the right time to almost anyone. People very often see some beautiful value in these teachings. They're very powerful, very down to earth, and very understandable. So that was what happened in when I was in Norway, and when I looked after my father's funeral. It was a very beautiful thing, the whole thing, and I wasn't really sad. To be honest, it didn't touch me in a very kind of deep way in terms of being sad. But of course, it was touching in another way. It was touching in more in a kind of rejoicing in a life lived well and being happy of what my father actually meant for me over those years. And I probably wouldn't be here as a Buddhist monk if it hadn't been for his acceptance and his encouragement and all these things. But what is interesting about this is that the idea of death, or the idea of being parted from things in our life, is a very important part of the Buddhist teachings. And one of the places this comes out very powerful and beautifully is in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which you may have heard of. This is the longest sutta, the longest discourse in the entire Buddhist canon. Yeah, it goes about 60 pages. And I have been doing it here on Sundays. On Sundays we do the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. But it's so long, we've been going for the past 2 or 3 years, and we still haven't finished. So tonight, only a very short extract. Otherwise we're going to be a long time. It's 8:30. We'll watch the time. So, Mahaparinibbana Sutta. This very beautiful story of the Buddha's final passing away. Very touching and very powerful. And it starts off with the Buddha starting out in Rajagaha, the capital of the ancient Magadhan Empire in India, walking north, walking towards his eventual point where he's going to end up, which is Kushinara. If you go to India, many of you have been to India? Have you been to India? No, you have not been to India? Okay. Some of you have been to India, perhaps. And you can go to these places today. That is one of the very wonderful things to do. You go to these places, you recognize them. The Buddha was here, and your hair stands on end. Sometimes your hair stands on end. Not in this case, but it can do if you have a bit more hair than I have. This is very beautiful. One of the places the Buddha goes to is Vesali, which is in the capital of the Vajjayan kingdom of ancient India. And here the Buddha spends the rains retreat. You can go to Vesali in the present day. There's nothing there except for ancient Buddhist ruins. Otherwise, it's a completely deserted place. The Buddha spends the rains retreat there, and during this rains retreat, he has some terrible pains and gets really, really sick. Almost on the verge of dying. And the Buddha thinks to himself that, well, either now I'm going to pass away, or I have to bring up some energy to make sure the body carries on a little bit longer. And of course, he brings up that energy, and the body carries on for another few weeks after this. But the Buddha is on the verge of dying, almost dead. Now this already is very interesting, because one of the things that I like to point out about the suttas, the word of the Buddha, is that sometimes you get things that are a little bit kind of magical in the suttas. And of course there are magical things, but those magical things are really about how deep you can go in meditation. That's the magic. You go into deep meditation and you bliss out like you have never done before. That's magic, and that's really worthwhile magic. But some of the magic in the suttas is of a different order, a different kind of magic. But when you read the suttas for the more naturalistic elements, you see that the Buddha, he was an old man, just like everyone else. The Buddha was one of humanity, he was one of us. And when you think about the Buddha in that way, as an ordinary human being, then these teachings are far, far more powerful, in my opinion, than if you think of the Buddha as some sort of slightly magical person who could do all kind of weird stuff. So the humanity of the Buddha comes out very powerfully. And this is already a very beautiful thing about this. To me, it is very useful. We need to remember to think about the Buddha in the right way. That is when his teachings become especially powerful. But then Venerable Ananda is the Buddha's attendant. He was the Buddha's attendant over the past 20 years. He is the one who remembered all these discourses by the Buddha and then passed them on to future generations later on. And Venerable Ananda goes to the Buddha and says, I felt it was such a terrible experience. I saw you were obviously being very sick, and I felt as if I was drugged, as if I was drunk. I couldn't see the directions clearly, what was up and what was down. I felt everything was so terrible. And of course, this is how we feel, if someone very important in our lives, we lose our bearings. We feel as if we are drugged. We feel as if, we get deluded, as I was saying before, because the dukkha, the suffering, is so powerful. And then, of course, and this is Venerable Ananda, one of the chief disciples of the Buddha, who feels like this. Imagine how ordinary people feel. Yeah, this is the Buddha passing away, the kind of the most, the greatest spiritual genius in human history from a Buddhist perspective. Yeah, this towering figure who solved everything in the Sangha, who looked after the monks and nuns all the time. Whenever there was an argument, he would try to settle it. Whenever there was a problem, he would lay down a rule. Whenever someone needed to be inspired, he would give another teaching. And now, he's about to die. You can imagine how powerful that moment actually is. Even someone like Venerable Ananda, who had very profound insight into his teachings, even he was crying, even he was in despair because of this very difficult situation. And then the Buddha sees this. And what does the Buddha say to him? And the Buddha says, "Haven't I taught you, Ananda, that everything and everyone that is dear and pleasing to you must become otherwise, must become separated from you?" In other words, he's telling Venerable Ananda that you haven't really taken his teaching fully on board yet. If you fully understood that all the things in the world that are pleasing and dearing to you, that they actually are of a nature to be separated from you, you wouldn't attach to them so much. You wouldn't hold on to them. You would find your refuge in a different place. The reason you are crying is because you're finding a refuge in these things. And this is the biggest problem that we do in the world. We find refuge in things that are not worthy of our refuge. Whenever you see something in the world that upsets you, when something in your family or in your work conditions or your daily life upsets you, when people behave in the wrong way, when people get sick and they die, when the environment goes down the drain, when there is terrorist bombings in Sri Lanka, when your father dies in Norway, what is going on there? Things that are dear and agreeable to you are becoming otherwise. Yes, take it on board. Don't find a refuge in that world, because that world is inherently unreliable. Inherently, it's going to let you down every time. Every time you attach to something, you're going to suffer the consequence of that attachment. Why? Because these things will have to go sooner or later. This is what the Buddha is saying. Yeah, and what is that world of things that are dear and pleasing to us? Well, that world is everything really in the five sensory realm. Because all the things that are dear and pleasing to in this world are found in that realm of the five senses. What we see, what we hear, what we feel, what we taste and what we smell. Yeah, that is the realm where everything we attach to is. So the Buddha saying here is actually incredibly radical. Yeah, he's saying that what almost our entire lives consist of, because this is what our lives is all about, that five sensory realm. From the moment you wake up in the morning to the time you go to bed at night, what do you experience? That is the realm you experience. And finally you want to have some rest, but no way you're going to get rest. You go to sleep and you continue dreaming about that realm as well. Yeah, you see more stuff, you hear more things, and you do all kind of weird, even more weird stuff when you dream. And then it carries on like this. And that's pretty much what our entire lives are about, except perhaps sometimes when you do a bit of meditation practice and you withdraw a little bit from that world. So the Buddha is saying, don't find your refuge in that world. Finding refuge in that world means that we have expectations of that world. And if you have expectations of that world, you're always going to be let down. It's always going to be troublesome. It is always going to be painful. The Buddha says, instead, you should make an island unto yourself. You should take the Dhamma as your island. Yeah, be an island unto yourself. What does that mean? And the Buddha says, what that means is that what we should do is that we should practice the mindfulness meditation of the suttas. The mindfulness meditation meaning Satipatthana practice. It means watching the breath, yeah, like we do here sometimes at the Buddha Society. That is where you find a refuge. Why is that? Because when you are an island unto yourself, when you watch the breath, when you find peace and happiness and joy and all of these good qualities right here within yourself, within your own mind, it is as if the external world doesn't matter anymore. It is as if you are free of the external world, because meaning, far more profound meaning than you ever can find in the external world, is found right there within yourself. That is your real refuge. That is where you find a degree of happiness over which you can have some degree of control, because your inner life is up to you to make something out of it. If you want to make something out of it, you can. If you want to practice all the way so you can actually live up to the simile of the soul, you can do that as well. That That is where you find that refuge. Go inside of yourself. One of those beautiful little teachings by Ajahn Chah, who used to be Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand, he says that in samadhi, in deep meditation, that is your real home. Your real home is inside of yourself. Why? Because that is for the first time all the fears, all the problems of the external world, all the things that always go wrong, they can no longer touch you. And now you have found a real security, a real liberation right there inside of yourself. This is really the purpose of meditation practice. Actually, it goes even further, but that is a really good start for the purpose of meditation practice. So this is what the Buddha says. Of course, you may think, well, what about me? You may think, I don't really get all this bliss and things in meditation. What am I supposed to do? I don't know if anyone of you thinks that, but sometimes people think that. And the answer to that is that the refuge actually starts at an even earlier point in our spiritual path. It starts when we start to live well, when we start to live with more kindness, when we avoid the anger and negativity, when we don't get angry, even when 260 people get murdered in Sri Lanka, still we keep our cool and we understand anger is not the right result, the right way to react. And because we get that, and because we start to live that spiritual life in our daily life, that is already the beginning of that inner refuge. Why? Because when you live well, you tend to feel good about yourself. Not only tend, you do feel good about yourself. And that inner feeling that you start to build up, that is the beginning of that refuge. This is why the spiritual life is so powerful. So this is the Buddha's message. Yeah, and this is what we should all be trying to head and remember the uncertainty of the world outside. Remember how dangerous it is. One of the beautiful Buddha similes is the simile of the borrowed goods. And the Buddha says, all the things in the external world, in the five sensory realm, are like borrowed things. Why? Because sooner or later, we're going to have to give it back. Every sight, everything that is dear to us in that world, is going to have to be let go of sooner or later. And if you don't let go of it, it's going to be snatched away from you. Yeah, nature is going to claim back these things. So how do we deal with borrowed things? If you rent a car or you have your own car, what is the difference in attitude to a rented car compared to your own car? What is the difference between a rented house and a house you own? What is the difference between something you know is a very short-term relationship compared to a long-term relationship? And the difference is that the rented things in life, we think about them in a different way. Yeah, we look after them still, but we don't have the same kind of attachment that you might otherwise have. That is the distinction. So instead of focusing on those things that are the rented things in life, the things that we borrow for a short while, we focus on those things that we own, because the things that we own are the things that we can carry with us long term into the future. What are the things that we own? And the Buddha said there's only one thing that we own. Only one thing that we own. You know what that is? This is not a quiz night, but anyway, just testing you. You know what that is? One thing that we own, said the Buddha, and that is karma. Karma is the only thing that when you die, you will take with you into the future. If you build up a beautiful mind in this life, if you build up joy and happiness and stillness, and I've been doing this for 23 years, and I've changed as a consequence, I'm happy to say. If you do that, then when you finally pass away, you have built up something very beautiful inside of you. And of course, that is what then continues into the future. In this way, you are the owner of your karma. You take it with you. This is the only thing you own. So invest in what you own. Just like when you have a car, don't invest in that rented car. Don't make it up. Don't make up that rented house. It's the house that you own that you should build up and make beautiful and nice and make into a wonderful environment for yourself. Why? Because you own it. You have a degree of control of it. You will enjoy the benefit of that in the future. Yeah. So that is where you place your investments, in those long-term things that you own. There's only one thing that is, and that is karma. Everything else is irrelevant. So that is the Buddha's kind of encouragement to us to remember impermanence and what that actually means in terms of refuge and where we should find real meaning in this life. But one other thing that is interesting, I just maybe briefly mention it as well, is that it's not just at the end of life when things kind of become clear. It's not just the idea of death, and death really here is a kind of a metaphor for impermanence in general, because death is kind of a very powerful point of impermanence and unreliability in our lives. But actually, the same is also true at the very beginning of the Buddha's path. Yeah, when we start out, is also the idea of death. Not just when we come to the end of our lives, but the whole thing that underpins the Buddhist philosophy and the way Buddhism works is also has to do with the idea of impermanence and even dying. And this is very fascinating, because the Buddha, when he started out and he had a very luxurious life when he started out. It's actually quite fascinating and quite sweet to read the description of a luxurious life in those days. Yeah, he was a young man. Yeah, he was kind of, before he went forth, he would have been in his 20s, maybe less than his 20s. And the things that he had for enjoying himself were what? 3 lotus ponds. Yeah, before the Buddha became, he had 3 lotus ponds for his enjoyment. This is how the young men enjoyed themselves 2,500 years ago. One with blue lotuses, one with red lotuses, one with white lotuses. Yeah, and that was his kind of, things have changed just a little bit, yeah, over 2,500 years. That's what young men used to do in those days. And then he had nice clothes, and he had all of these kind of things as well. But that was kind of the height of, maybe not the height, but that was a big part of the enjoyment. It's kind of sweet. But then, of course, having all of this enjoyment and having all of these lotus ponds or whatever, then he understands that actually there is a very big problem in life. And that is the fact that you're going to get old and die. Yeah, and the more he reflected on this, one of the things that he reflected is that it is not me, only me, who's going to die, but all of these things that I'm interested in this world. What are the things I'm interested in? Wife, children, possessions, yeah? Everything in the external world that seems interesting to me, all that also is going to die. All that too is going to disappear. If I spend my life pursuing things that I know are going to die, that are going to have to disappear, then I pursue that, and because I pursue them, I will attach to them. All I'm doing is asking for suffering in the future. Yeah, all of these things I will obviously get attached to. If you spend all your energy, all your time pursuing things that you, whatever it is, of course, you're going to be attached to those things. That's just the way things are. And then he realizes, all I'm doing is asking for suffering in the future, because eventually these things are going to be subject to death. They're going to fall away. And I too, the Buddha too, is going to be subject to the same death. So this understanding that everything in the world is impermanent, that life has a limit, that everything you grasp onto and you hold onto is going to have to go one day, that thing was enough for the Buddha to decide the ordinary life is not worthwhile. I'm going to have to go forth and become a monk instead. That's kind of astonishing, isn't it? This was the main driving force of the Buddha to be before he became the Buddha, the idea of death. Such a simple idea, an idea that every one of us thinks that we know already. But the point, of course, is that we don't know it, or we know it only in a very shallow way. We only have a very narrow understanding of what it actually means. But the potential for the death contemplation is so much that it makes the Buddha to be go forth and become a monastic. It is the thing that sets in motion this whole enormous thing that we call the Buddhist teachings today. The Buddha goes forth because of that, then eventually he finds awakening, and then he starts this teaching called Buddhism, the Dhamma, and he brings it out into the world. And after 2,500 years, we are still the beneficiaries of that. Why? Because one man thought about the idea of death in a very profound way. So the very starting point of Buddhism really comes from this whole idea of dying, because that is one of the very powerful moments of impermanence in our life. And then you expand that out to bring everything into the picture, and then you start to understand how the world actually works and where to find refuge and where not to find refuge. And what happens when you do this? What happens when you do this is another one of my favorite similes in the sutta, the similes of the mountain. And this is where the Buddha says the simile of 2 friends coming to a mountain. And when the 2 friends come to the base of the mountain, or maybe it's just more like a hill probably, One friend says to the other one, let's go up and have a look at the top and see what it looks like. Have a look at the view. And the other friend said, nah, whatever, you go up. I couldn't be bothered. Yeah, it's too much work, too hard work. Like spiritual path usually is a bit of hard work, yeah? No, okay, forget about it. You go, I'll wait down here. So the friend goes up to the top of the mountain, and he goes up to the top of the mountain, and he looks out, and he shouts down to his friend on the bottom, hey, yeah, up here, I can see fields, I can see villages, I can see roads, I can see rivers, I can see so much. Wow, this is amazing. Come up. And the fellow at the bottom says, no way that you can see those things at the top there. I don't believe a word of what you're saying here. Now the guy, the fellow at the top, he gets a bit exasperated, yeah, with his friend, thinks his friend is being just a little bit too stubborn. So he goes down to the bottom of the hill, grabs his mate by the arm, and pulls him up the mountain. And he says to him, okay, what do you see here? Oh yeah, he says a bit sheepishly, yeah, you're right, I see fields, villages, you know, roads and rivers and all of these kind of things. And then the other friend said, well, how come just now you were saying that you didn't see any of these things? Well, because this whole mountain was in the way. This whole mountain was blinding me. And of course, that mountain, what that mountain is a simile for the hindrances of the mind, for the five senses that block us from seeing something higher. When we get out of those hindrances, when we get out of those five senses that we carry with us all the time, and we climb the mountain of meditation, we climb the mountain of samadhi, for the first time in our lives, we get a perspective, we understand what is going on. It is like the famous simile of the tadpole. The tadpole has no idea what water is as long as it is in the water. One day the tadpole becomes a frog, and then it thinks, yeah, oh, that's what water is. Maybe it doesn't think that, but that's kind of the simile anyway. Maybe the tadpole doesn't think anything at all, but that's kind of the idea. Then it knows what water is all about, because it comes out of the water. Yeah. In the same way, you have to climb the mountain of meditation. And as you do that, as you start to find the stillness and the happiness within, as you start to find that refuge the Buddha was pointing to, you start to understand the impermanence, the unreliability, and the ability for the world outside always to let you down. You start to understand that for the first time. And you climb up, and you get the bird's eye view, and you understand the nature of existence, the nature of meditation practice, and the problems in the ordinary world around us. Very, very powerful, and so beautiful. And then all of these things start to shift. And then, of course, then you are never angry again if someone dies. It never upsets you. It's never a problem anymore, because you understood the nature of the world, and you have a refuge that is far, far more profound, that is far more blissful. Will you feel true peace and true happiness? And this is the path where you actually do find real meaning of life. And as I always like to say, this is where you actually find the very answer to the meaning of life itself. Anyway, that there you are. That is just some random reflections on the what happened in Sri Lanka, and also on my father's passing away. So that's it. Okay. Okay. Are there any? Yeah, please bring it up. Are there any questions anyone would like to ask, or any complaints that I am too callous and too hard-hearted and not really compassionate enough, or anything like that? Please, you know, it's okay. You're allowed to say many things. Yeah. Anyone want to ask anything here? Is everyone here? Nobody wants to ask anything here. Is that because you are? Yes, Jenny.
Don't belong to you.
Yeah.
Which is not your investment, which is yourself.
Yeah.
I think about putting your energy. Yes, I understand putting your energy into yourself so you have energy left over. But putting energy into other people to give them that hand up the hill. So when you said that, I thought, that's a bit strange.
Okay. So what I mean is not so much what you do. I'm talking more about the attitude to how you do things. So by putting the energy in the things that are rented, what I mean is focusing too much on material things and kind of having desire for material phenomena, and then maybe even not practicing morality properly because material things are so important to you. So what I mean is your attitude for how you live your life more than anything else. So it is just like, you know, you can still carry on doing exactly the same thing that you did before, but now you do it with kindness, now you do it with generosity, now you do it with an attitude, knowing that morality in everything you do is absolutely necessary. That includes helping other people, yeah? When you're helping other people, it's not, you're not doing anything for yourself, you're doing something both for them and for yourself at the same time. This is really one of the beautiful ways of thinking about the spiritual practice or any action that is spiritual. Anything that is both good for you and for other people, that is a spiritual act or a Buddhist act, if you like. Yeah, yeah? That is kind of a very nice and simple way of thinking about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Doing something nice for somebody and you're feeling so good about it. That made sense to me.
Absolutely.
Didn't quite understand your similarity.
Yeah, good. Yeah, sorry, I was probably going a bit too fast, but yeah, as always. Yeah, good. Thanks for bringing it up. Okay. Peter.
Somebody told me that the stream runner understands that consciousness is not self.
Mm.
Obviously, that's an insight gained through jhana.
Yeah.
But I don't understand how that is so, and are we supposed to separate consciousness from nama rupa somehow?
Okay, so you're saying that the stream mentor understands consciousness as non-self?
Mm.
And how you're supposed to do that? And how you're supposed to see that?
Well, it's obvious how you practice the Eightfold Path, but
yeah.
I'm just asking for hints.
For hints? Okay. Well, I think... I think that the hint is just that you have to get to samadhi first. Yeah, that's really the thing here. Because it is that path into samadhi that shows you, gives you so much of the data that allows you to see non-self and also suffering and impermanence. That very path will actually, because that when you practice that path, you literally see things fading away and disappearing. Yeah. Your body fades away, disappearing, your senses fade away, disappear, all of these things disappear. And that is how you start to uncover these three characteristics. But without that data that you get through your meditation experience, it's not going to happen. Yeah, so really, that is really the way. Yeah, anything else is going to be very shallow and not really going to be a proper understanding of things. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? You sure don't want to ask? Yeah, this only opportunity only comes once a week on Friday nights. Yeah, you can ask anything you want. All those questions you always wanted to ask, but you didn't dare to ask. Now is the opportunity here.
Got another one.
Another one. Okay, so you're gonna. Okay, go for another one.
Right, I was sitting with Ajahn Brahm a few years ago, and there was like a crowd of 10 of us just chilling, and I asked him, will Maitreya come?
Mm.
And he said, yes, Maitreya will come, but none of us will be here. And like Maitreya in the suttas, like I looked, and I only found one reference.
Mm.
Perhaps there's more. But it was like a really weird sutta, and it only had three parallels.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yes, the answer is that Maitreya, the name Maitreya only occurs in one sutta, and in the parallels, it doesn't even occur in one of the parallels. Yeah. So I think that the idea of future Buddhas is okay, but the idea of a particular Buddha arising at a particular time, I think that is probably some later invention. I don't think that came from the Buddha himself. So.
No, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't understand.
Yeah. Okay, let's take some questions from overseas. This is DY in the USA. What is the point for further advancement in technology and medicine when human ego is at its worst? Okay. what you're asking, is it better to reduce the ego? Is that what you're saying? So forget about technology and medicine, reduce the ego instead, because that will have more beneficial impact. Is that what the point is? Or, well, I think the point is that technology and medicine, you know, we do what we can in the world to help people out. And say that someone works in a medical company or they work as a doctor or a nurse or something, yeah, it's a wonderful job to have, to be able to help other people. Yeah, it's always good to help other people. In fact, this is very much part of the spiritual path. And if we're able to use technology in a skillful way, sometimes I don't know whether we are, but if we are, that too can be useful. Actually, right now here, Friday night, this is good use of technology, yeah, live streaming on the internet. But sometimes it can be used well, but often it is not. Yeah, technology can also be used in many bad ways. So it depends how you use these things. But if they are used in a good way, it is always going to be good. If you use technology to enhance your ego or to kind of do bad things in any way, of course, then it is going to be useless. But technology and medicine are kind of neutral in their own right. And if we use them in a good way, then they actually become beneficial for humanity. And of course, that is up to each one individual of us, individually. Is that what you're asking? I'm not entirely sure, but that's what it seems like. And I agree with you, ego is of course a problem, and it creates so much clashes and so many problems in our world, and it's a wonderful thing to reduce our egos a little bit, and to be a bit more humble, and to be a bit more uncertain, and less judgmental of other people and other beings, and have more kindness and all these kind of things. Absolutely, I certainly agree with that. Anyway, next one, Shiha in Singapore. Is it okay if we are not at the highest state of mind all the time? is it okay? Let me just finish the question. Can we mourn and be down about death or a bad situation? I find it hard to be happy all the time. Yes, mourning, of course. I'm not suggesting that people should suppress their feelings or they should not be sad when someone dies. That is not the right way of doing things at all. What I'm suggesting is that there is our alternative ways of looking at this. And with those alternative ways, we can reduce the suffering a little bit. And I don't think we need to add more sadness to the world. If we can do things in a way that leads to more inspiration and wisdom, why not use those ways instead? There may still be a little bit of sadness left, but let's also add something. Time of death, time of terrorist acts are a great opportunity for insight and understanding into our nature and the human nature. So let's use those powerful, pregnant opportunities to actually make something out of them. Because then we are actually growing rather than just being sad. So don't think that you don't have to be happy all the time. That's not really the point. It's impossible anyway, as you say. Happiness comes and goes. The main point of the spiritual path is that we are improving. We're going somewhere. There's a feeling that we have less suffering than we used to have. Our peaks of happiness are higher than they used to be. Our average happiness is better. We have more peace. We have more of all of these things. And as long as you are improving, then eventually you're going to get to the very highest end of the Buddhist path. And even the arahant, even the fully enlightened person does not have the same kind of happiness all the time. And that is why even the arahant, the enlightened person, likes to go and meditate, hang out in caves, be by themselves, dismiss all the ordinary people, okay, time to go. And that's what arahants do, they say, okay, time to go. Have you seen that? Haven't seen that? No? Okay, but this is what they do. It's also in the suttas. Everything I say is quotes from the suttas. That's what they say. Okay, time to go. And then they chill out. Yeah, they go into the cave and then meditate, and they have an even higher happiness through that meditation practice. So even for the arahants, happiness isn't always steady. For them too, it is up and down. So that is not really the point. But you should have the highest state of mind all the time in terms of doing what is right. In terms of living well, in terms of having good intention, in terms of trying to do the right thing, that should always be at the forefront of your mind if you can. In that sense, but even when you feel a bit down, even when you feel the world is going in the wrong way or whatever, still you try your very best to be kind, to do the right thing. In that sense, ideally, you should have a good state of mind. Okay. So there you are. Any last orders? No? Okay. Let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Sāmi Sūpatipanno